First of all, I should tell you that, what I'm going to talk about today, it's possible that everything I say today is buried in a couple of papers, one by Reinhard Werner in 2001, another one by Massanes, Assen, and Jasson in 2005. That's possible, but I'm not sure. And so I'm going to use my own uncertainty about this as an excuse to give the talk. Even if it's all there, I think it deserves to be more widely appreciated. And it's also the case, it's also possible that that all I will tell you that will be new to you is a point of view that no actual equations that are written are equations that you haven't seen before. Okay, so let's see if we can make that work. Okay, here's how I learned about Bell inequalities, Bell's theorem, in school. First of all, it was a response to the famous argument by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen. And basically what EPR had argued was that that if you take, so here's the EPR argument, if you take quantum mechanics, the behavior of systems described by quantum mechanics, in particular the behavior of entangled systems, and then you impose a kind of a reasonableness condition. They called it their criterion of reality. And basically it says that the criterion of reality is that if you fiddle with something over here, it shouldn't have any effect over there. I'm going to claim that essentially their criterion of reality amounts to a locality condition the way they use it, but this is not a talk about EPR, and we can discuss the shades of meaning other times. Fascinating paper by EPR, but maddening. Okay. Plus locality, I'm saying their criterion of reality basically is used in this way. But this means that you have to say that there are things in the world that are real, but which are not described by quantum mechanics, namely the outcomes of measurements of complementary measurements on a system. These have to be real in certain circumstances. So quantum mechanics is incomplete, and in particular, you can think of this as saying that there must be. Hidden variables in the world that are not and cannot be described by quantum mechanics. So this is the this is how I learned about EPR. And so what Bell did, of course Bohr had a response to EPR. Bohr's response was basically not so fast. The fact remains, even though if you have two remote systems. You can do one experiment or another on this system, system number one. Even though that system is far away from this system, it nevertheless remains true that these two possible measurements that you're making on system number one are mutually exclusive. They're logically exclusive of each other. And therefore, you can only do one or the other. You can't do both. And so the logic of complementarity applies. And he said that made the EPR criterion of reality ambiguous. That was Bohr's response. Well, 30 years pass, and then Bell comes along, and so here's what Bell does. And I'm going to give not exactly what Bell does, but a simplified version of probably the easiest Bell theorem to explain to your grandmother. That's the one by Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, and Holt. He says, look, suppose we have a thing that produces pairs of systems. Here's system number one over here. I guess I'll put number one. We'll read from left to right, and number two over here. And on this system, I can make one of two measurements. I can make measurement of A or measurement of B. Over here, I can make a measurement of C or a measurement of D. And let's suppose that the situation is that the results of these measurements, the outcomes of these measurements, are all either plus or minus 1 in every instance. And then Bell says this. He says, well, actually, Hauser, Honisher, Money, and Holt say it this way, but it all amounts to the same thing. He says, all right, let's make two assumptions. Let's make the assumption of hidden variables. And in other words, we're going to assume that A, B, C, and D all actually have values at any given run of the experiment. And we're also going to make an assumption of locality, which means the choice of our experiment on number one doesn't affect the outcome of the experiment on number two. And that's important because in order to give an unambiguous a meaning to saying that the value of A is plus one, I want to say that the value of A, if I measured A, would be plus one. And I don't want to have to say the value of A would be plus one if I measured A and over on the other system I measured D. Okay? The purpose of locality is so that I can simply say that the outcome, I can tell you what the outcome of A would be if I measured A with no further commentary. Just a sign of it. I tell you that in this particular instance of the experiment, I have that. And he says, what comes of this? What comes of this? And in the Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, Holt version, what you do is you consider the quantity, which is A times C minus D plus B times C plus D. All of these values exist. If C and D are the same, then this is 0 and this is plus or minus 2. If C and D are different, then this is 0 and this is plus or minus 2. So no matter what happens, this has to be plus or minus 2, and therefore, if I take the average of this quantity over a great many statistical trials, that average will have to be between minus 2 and plus 2. And of course, I could write that this way. It's all old stuff, but I want to tell you how I learned it in school, so now I can tell you how I think about it today. That the absolute value of this combination of averages has to be less than or equal to 2. And of course, although we might not be able to measure both A and B on number 1 and both C or D on number 2, we can choose in different instances of this experiment to measure any combination we like. So we can individually measure, statistically, these guys. We can individually measure them. And this is the a Bell inequality, or a Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, Holt inequality, or something. It's an inequality. We'll call it a Bell inequality as a generic term. It's not the one that Bell derived, but it sort of has the same meaning. And we can actually subject that to experimental tests. Of course, in quantum mechanics, it doesn't work out. In quantum mechanics, we can have two spins in a singlet state. And we can measure components of the spin on each side. And just to remind you, if you don't remember, so suppose this were A and this were C, and the angle between them was theta. Then for two spins in a singlet state, the expectation of AC, when you measure the spins in units of h bar over 2, the expectation of HC is just minus the cosine of the angle between them. And if you have such a situation, then you can set up some directions, these will do. I'll write the possible directions for system number one and solid lines. These guys are at right angles, and then D is like this, C is like this, and you work it out. You work out this combination. Okay, and This is pi over 4, of course. You work out this combination, and you find that that all of these guys are 1 over the square root of 2, except AD, which is minus 1 over the square root of 2, and that's exactly enough to make this 2 times the square root of 2, and therefore quantum mechanics violates Bell's inequality. And therefore, if you make the assumption of hidden variables and locality, you get something which is not quantum mechanics. Whatever it is, it does not agree with the experimental facts of life about quantum mechanics, because you can do these experiments, and they've been done many times with varying varying degrees of cleverness, and quantum mechanics works, and therefore, so the school story goes, there's no local hidden variable theory can be right, because no local hidden variable theory can reproduce the experimental consequences of quantum theory. And therefore, the EPR argument must be wrong, because if you take their conclusion and a version of one of their hypotheses, you actually contradict their other hypothesis. So let's talk a little bit about the structure of this argument. We have some hypothetical assumptions about the world, hidden variables and locality. And these are assumptions about the results of experiments, including unperformed experiments, including ones that we never actually can do. Perhaps it's only for inessential technical reasons, but it appears that we have to choose whether to do A or B on number one. But the hidden variables assumption is that all of these guys already have values. We can talk about the values of unperformed experiments. And locality, there's actually this locality assumption is pretty strong, because it says not that our choice of measurement on particle number one doesn't affect any statistical frequencies on particle number two. The assumption is that the choice of measurement on particle number one doesn't affect the outcome on particle number two. The locality assumption is also an assumption about these sort of unknown hidden variables. So locality is in fact stronger. The locality assumption is stronger than the assumption no observable effect. That our choice of measurement on number one has no observable effect at number two. That just by looking at number two, you can't tell what the choice of measurement on number one is. That actually is true. But the locality assumption that is actually at work is stronger than that. And I think that this is, in fact, the real issue in Bohr's reply, in some buried, complicated, folded over, typically Bohr way. But that's what's going on. All right. I won't talk about Bohr anymore, I promise. This is how I know I'm getting older. I tend to think about Bohr a lot. So anyway. Now, of course, we don't have to have full determinism in this. The way I phrased it, I was saying, everything's deterministic. Well, we don't have to have full determinism. It suffices to have something like this. Let me get this chalk. It suffices to have that some joint probability of some outcomes of measurements on one and two, that this probability, given the values of the hidden variables, that joint probability, that these are actually independent, given the value of the hidden variables. The correlations between A and C are all due to their common correlation with these hidden factor, this hidden factor a lambda. This suffices for that. In other words, it's perfectly okay for God to throw dice, but he has to throw the dice locally. He has to throw dice over here for the outcomes of this experiment, and he can throw separate independent dice over here for the outcome of this experiment, and that's good enough. The point is that the correlations are mediated by hidden factors, but there may be an additional randomness. So it suffices to make assumptions like this. Conditional independence. Conditional independence. So all the correlations are due to common correlations with these shared variables. You have similar structure to the arguments for all the other great variants of Bell's theorem, the Hardy theorem, the Greenberger-Horn-Zeilinger GHZ argument, the more recent Conway-Cochin free will theorem. All these have the same structure, where you have an assumption which sometimes people some set of assumptions which sometimes people express as local realism, and these lead to predictions which are at odds with quantum mechanical effects that we observe in the world. Sometimes these are effects, statistical frequency effects. Sometimes they're things that happen with probability 0 or 1, as in the GHZ axiom. So this is how it all works. Okay, that's what I learned in school. Another thing that we've learned over the last few years is, well, we keep learning the fact that entanglement is pretty amazing. And it's amazing in a lot of ways. And a very important property of quantum entanglement is the property that has come to be called monogamy. Okay? And it's an almost inevitable term. Romantic metaphors are irresistible in talking about entanglement. It goes back at least to Shimoni's Passion at a Distance. Which I still think is a great phrase. I don't know what it means, but it's a terrific phrase. In fact, the last talk I gave about this stuff was called The Private Lives of Quantum Particles. I mean, I thought about using that title this time, but that wouldn't have sounded serious. So the idea is that the more that particle 1 and particle 2 are entangled with each other, the less they can be entangled with other things like 3 and 4 and 5, all these other particles out in the world. The more they're entangled with each other, the less they can be entangled with other things. Extreme example, of course, is maybe, so we're drawing a line here because now we're talking about monogamy. Maybe 1 and 2 are in a pure entangled state. That's as entangled as you can get. A pure entangled state. If they're in a pure entangled state, then you know that if you have a third particle present, it cannot be entangled with these at all. In fact, a three-particle state involving this, if it's a pure state, would have to be something like this. It would have to be a product state. And they not only can't be entangled with other systems, they can't even be correlated with other systems. This is pure. If the overall system is in a mixed state, that mixed state must be of the form the projector onto the pure entangled state 1 and 2 tensor product of the density matrix for number 3, there can't be any correlations at all. So if two things are in a pure entangled state, then they are completely unentangled, in fact, completely uncorrelated with everything else. Now, if we move away from talking about pure entangled states to mixed states, things get a lot more interesting. Just mention a couple of things about this that I understand. I don't understand all about it by any means. We could imagine talking about sort of how monogamous things are. We can perturb off the idea of just being monogamous to being, polygamous, but only up to a point. For example, actually, it helps if I look at the right page. Suppose I have three systems, and I'll call them 1, 2, and 2 prime. And it turns out we can find we can find a global state for all these guys, global quantum state, such that 1 and 2 are entangled, but it's a mixed state, And 1 and 2 prime are also entangled in a mixed state. And in fact, it's even better because it turns out that the mixed state for 1, 2 is the same as the mixed state for 1, 2 prime. But these are the same state. I'm assuming these are kind of copies of each other, some sort of agreed upon isomorphism between their Hilbert spaces. And so this would say that, if you will, that 1 has the same relationship to 2 that it has to 2 prime. So their relationship is not, strictly speaking, monogamous, okay? But quantum mechanics, but you can have a situation so that quantum mechanics forbids the existence of 2 double prime with rho 1 2 double prime equal to rho 1 2, which is the same as rho 1 2 prime. In other words, you can have a state, which can be shared a little bit in the sense that 1 and 2 can have the same state as 1 and 2 prime, but you can't add a 2 double prime. That's not allowed. This is possible. And in fact, there's a sort of a nice general recipe for coming up with such examples. This is kind of fun. Let me just show you as a little aside here. So suppose we have a bunch of qubits. They're spins. And what we do is, let's put 1 here. And over here we'll have 2, forgive my notation, 2 sub 1, 2 sub 2, and so on, all the way down to 2 sub n. Okay? And now I'm going to draw lines from 1 to each of the others. And each line is a term in the Hamiltonian. A term which is just the dot product of the spins of the two guys. Okay? Now if there were only one of them, the ground state of that thing would be the singlet state. And so if the Hamiltonian is the sum of all these things, one would like to be in a singlet state with everybody. But one can't be in a singlet state with everybody because they're all there. So what you do is you look at the ground state. The ground state, find the ground state for that Hamiltonian H. Okay? And that ground state will be a state such that has two important properties. First of all, rho of 1, 2 sub k is the same state, the same entangled state for each. I think it's a Werner state. And the second point is, quantum mechanics forbids us from having an n plus first one that is also in the same state forbids a 2 n plus 1 with the same rho 1, 2 sub n plus 1. In other words, I can't have another guy which happens to be in the same state that I just found for all the others. So this is one where you have a relationship between systems which is shareable in the sense that one can have the same relationship with 2 and 2 sub 1 and 2 sub 2 and all the way up to 2 sub n, but not 2 sub n plus 1. You can draw the line anywhere. Yeah, Robin.
Jamielkowski equivalent to the optimal n-way cloning map?
I have no idea. Okay, so right. Now notice all of this depends on the structure of quantum mechanics. When I said that there can't be a 2 double prime, I said, well, quantum mechanics forbids that. The fact that the overall state has to be represented by a density operator that acts on some Hilbert space for the whole smash. I'm assuming that. That's how I get the fact that this can't happen. It's how I get the fact that this happens. It depends on the structure of quantum mechanics. It's a fact about quantum mechanics. Okay? It's an important fact about quantum mechanics, I would say. But I want to think about this more like in the spirit of Bell's theorem, by thinking about what the world might be like. Let's not put in quantum mechanics too early into our thinking. Okay, so off we go. So let's think about things in general. In general, we've got some systems hanging around. Okay, here they're hanging around. I've got system one and system two, and maybe there's some other systems around, three and four. There are a few systems around, and I have some way of producing these systems. I have a way of producing, I have a procedure for coming up with these guys, so I can do experiments many times. I can get groups of systems like this that were prepared in the same way, and maybe there's some factors I can't control, but they are what they are. I just have a way of producing these things over and over. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick two of these guys. Oh, let's pick one and two. I got colors. Let's pick one and two. And I'm going to be making various measurements on these systems. And by measurements, I don't really want to invoke the whole structure of quantum mechanics. I just mean there are going to be some interventions in these systems that somehow give me some data. We're not necessarily talking about quantum mechanics here. So here I can make measurement A or B or what have you. Over here I can make C or D or what have you. Okay, and I have lots of choices for each system, at least two. And what I want to talk about is what I'll call the statistical relation between one and two. The statistical relation, I'll call it R12. And what do I mean by the statistical relation? Well, okay. If I choose a measurement on one and a measurement on two, and I look at the probability distribution for the outcomes of that measurement, I'll get something like this: P of, let's say, A, C, given that I made measurement of A on number one and measurement of C on number two. I'll just get some joint probability distribution. And what I want to do is I want to take the set of all such distributions for all A and C choices, okay? And that will be what I mean by my statistical relation between these two systems. The statistical relation involves only measurable quantities. In fact, what it is it's just the description of all the correlations between possible measurements of these systems. If I can do this experiment many, many times, I can do some statistics and I can begin to sort of identify the statistical relationship with the system. So I have here measurement outcomes and choices, and I'm going to assume that this exists and that I can check it by doing the experiment many times. Now, the existence of a statistical relationship is, or statistical relation, the existence of that relation is a non-trivial assumption, because one of the things that I'm doing is I'm assuming that it's good enough just to specify what A and C are, that some other choices of measurements or interventions on the other systems lying around, those other choices don't affect the distribution of outcomes on system one and system two. So there is a kind of a locality here, but notice that assumption of locality is a testable one, because I could take these systems and I could try my various experiments and I could try them doing one thing with system three and four, and I could try them doing another thing with system three and four, and so on, and I could observe whether the statistics changed depending on how I intervened with system three and four. Notice what I'm not assuming. I'm not assuming that these measurement results are independent of measurement results of things that are done on 3 and 4. It might be that if I condition on the measurement outcome of 3 and 4, then I get a quite different distribution. Sure, fine. Also, I'm not assuming that the measurement result on number 1 is independent of the measurement choice on number 2. I make no such assumption. I only get this when I make both choices. Okay? They might be non-local. Might be non-local in an observable way. It might be that even the probability distribution over number 1 outcomes depends on what I did to number 2. There might be a possibility of faster-than-light communication here. I'm not assuming any sort of locality that way. The locality that I'm assuming is simply that it suffices to tell what measurements I make on 1 and 2 in order to write down the distribution of the results. That's what I mean by a statistical relation. And the existence of a statistical relation is an assumption. Okay, now, so the mere correlations of these guys' measurement results with these guys' measurement results, that's okay. And I can test whether there's a statistical relation in this system, this case, by checking, by doing various experiments where I do first, for one set of experiments, I do one thing to 3 and 4, and for another set of experiments, I do another thing. I can actually test it. So this is subject to experimental verification. Now, the statistical relation includes a description of all the correlations between the systems. That's what it is. And so it's just a compendium of observable things. Yeah?
Is it possible to ground that assumption in an assumption no signaling by saying 1 and 2 were very far away from 3 and 4?
Sure.
You could.
Okay. You could. If you wanted to give an argument for why that should be true, or why you might, that's a very reasonable assumption. Okay. What I want to say is that in the laboratory, we observe correlations between particles that are independent of a lot of things that are going on in the laboratory. And so I would say that this is kind of it's empirically based. It's, oh yeah, well it turns out that the statistics I got in my experiment are independent of what my colleague's doing next door on his particles. So it turns out that they're next door, but the fact that they're removed in space is not essential. What's essential is that they're not interacting in some way. And there's no because you could have degrees of freedom which are non-interacting, but actually are located physically together. And then you say, oh yeah, well, what's happening to the position degree of freedom is not really affecting the spin degree of freedom or something. Okay. All right. So here's my question. My question is our statistical relation between 1 and 2, is this relation, R1-2, is it shareable? In other words, could there be 1 prime and 2 prime so that the statistical relationship between 1 and 2 is the same as the statistical relation between 1 and 2 prime, which is the same as the statistical relation between 1 prime and 2, which is the same as the statistical relation between 1 prime and 2 prime? Could these guys sort of have a connection like this? Could we have systems 1, 2, 1 prime and 2 prime, and this relation is the same as that one, is the same as that one, is the same as that one? I'm not asking to have them, to actually have 1 prime and 2 prime. I'm just wondering if it would be possible in principle to have them. Yes, Robin.
Why, given that you explicitly are allowing the outcome little a to depend on the choice big C.
Sure. In principle.
Right. Why? But then we say that the outcome little a cannot depend on the choice of what I do to 3.
To the other guys here, right?
And I'm bothered. You drew a cloud. We've got 1, 2, 3, and 4 sitting
yep.
there. But now there's something different about 1 and 2 than about 1 and 3.
Well, why is there something different? It may be. I, 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 um, I still want to assume that the statistical relation between 1 and 2, that the, that in order to calculate the probability distributions of 1 and 2 outcomes, I do not need to know what's happening with 2 prime. And it may be that the case that they're, I'm still going to assume that. However, it may be that the assumption, which I'm about to make, that it is shareable, that may enforce a kind of additional locality. But the point is that I'm not enforcing locality, I'm enforcing shareability. Okay, and that's a consequence of shareability. Maybe so. Okay, but the existence of the statistical relation itself does not impose that. Is that an answer to your question?
Good enough.
Okay, good, okay. All right, because I didn't answer the last one, so I felt really bad. Yeah. Is the Robin rule in effect? Robin was a student, and a student in my department. And there was a Robin rule which said 3 questions. Okay. All right, so, sorry, yeah?
Is the statistical relation R12, how does it relate to the probability?
Oh, what I mean is the statistical relationship is the set of all these guys for all the possible choices of A and C measurements. It's just all the distributions put in a box so I can figure it out. So it's a compendium of all the correlations. Yeah. Yes.
The point is, just to see if I'm following.
It's the time to do it.
Depending on, for some statistical relations, the answer to that could there be question?
Could there be?
Yes, and for some statistical relations, it's probably going to be no.
Yeah. Okay. So could there be 1 prime and 2 prime so that this is true? Now, correlation between classical variables. If I have just a couple of classical variables and I have their joint probability distribution is their statistical relation, of course there could be other variables which are correlated to X, just like Y is. There could be another Y that has the same correlation. You can have more than one copy of the newspaper. The newspaper is kind of correlated to the evening newscast, but you have lots of copies of the newspaper. You can have lots of copies of the evening newscast. They're all correlated in exactly the same way. So, so that's possible. I'm not asking you to make these guys. I'm not asking you to take this and to create these. No, that might be too hard. I'm not requiring you even to possess such things. I'm just asking if the existence of such things anywhere is conceivable. So if you claimed that it was conceivable, that means somewhere out there, there's a 1 prime and a 2 prime. Okay? And so I could imagine an experiment that involved them. And if you claimed that you had a quartet of systems, 1, 1 prime, 2, 2 prime, that had this property, if you claimed that you had this property, then I could check it. I could do lots of tests and see that the joint distributions along all these lines were all the same. I could check the claim that this machine is producing quartets of systems with this property. Okay, so we're staying pretty close to something that you can check. You can check empirically if you had them. And I'm not requiring that you produce them. Just asking if that could be, if they could be out there somewhere. Okay, and of course, what we're going to do is I'm going to do the same thing I did over there. We're going to suppose that all these measurement outcomes come out to plus or minus 1. And I'm going to imagine that I have my systems, because you said that I'm going to assume that they exist. I'm going to assume that they exist, so assume that the answer to that question is yes. 2 and 2 prime, and I'm going to have this relation. I'm going to imagine that I measure A on 1 and B on 1 prime. So I'll call that B prime, just to remind myself that that's actually a measurement on 1 prime. It's not a measurement on 1, because I chose to measure A on 1. And I can't only make one measurement on the system, right? So here, this is going to be C, and this one's going to be D prime. And so I could make these quartet of measurements. I could get data. Each row of my table of data would have 4 entries, an entry for each of these measurements. I could then do statistics on that data record. And of course, since all the numbers, all the entries are plus or minus 1, it must be that AC minus AB prime plus B prime C plus B prime D prime, that must be plus or minus 2. And since I can just do statistics on those columns, I can take the average of this, and it must be that the absolute value of these averages, B prime C, of course, B is done with the prime guy, plus B prime D prime, it must be that that is less than or equal to 2. It just has to be true. But of course, we assumed that 1 prime, 2, and 2 prime have the same statistical relationship, the same 1-2 statistical relationship according to this diagram, that each of these lines represents the same statistical relationship. That means the same R's. That means that the expectation value of AC, of course, that's just the expectation value of AC, but the expectation of AD prime has to be the same as the expectation would be if I made the measurements all on the unprimed guys, the guys I actually have. And this must be the same as the results that I would get. The same expectation. I can't say that they have the same results. How could I say that? But they would have the same probability distribution and thus the same expectation for B and C. And here, they have to be the same expectation for B and D. And therefore, this must be less than or equal to 2. Oh, yeah, we've seen that before. Because the statistical relationship between 1 and 2 prime is exactly the same as the statistical relationship between 1 and 2. Therefore, these expectations must be equal. It's the same probability distribution.
If D had been measured on 1.
But this, I can check this by doing repeated experiments on not on just the ones that I actually have, 1 and 2. Okay? So I don't actually have to have 1 prime and 2 prime to draw this conclusion. I simply have to say that they conceivably exist somewhere. Yes?
That's the statement that if that quartet of equality of ours is true,
yes,
it's logically necessary that that bottom relation holds.
Exactly.
Even if 1 prime and 2 prime don't exist.
Even if they don't actually exist. The question is whether they could conceivably exist. Whether it might be true that they exist. All that it is so far, right? So, microphone. So we do some experiments. We make a quantum mechanical situation. We do some experiments just on 1 and 2, our spins 1 and 2, and we find after we do these spin experiments, like we did for, we find that the world is quantum mechanical, and this is violated. Okay. Oh, no, no, no. The whole point is because in our assumption about the imaginary world that the relation between 1 and 2 is not monogamous but can be shared in this way, that there could be elsewhere in the universe, perhaps outside my laboratory, systems 1 prime and 2 prime that are related to each other and to my systems in the same way, then the fact that this is a conceivable experiment where I operate on all of them means that this must be true. But because the statistical relationships of every pair are the same, this expectation is the same as that one. Pretty trivial. But this one must be the same as that one. This one must be the same as that one. This one must be the same as that one. But now I've arrived at a conclusion that only involves 1 and 2. Because 1 prime and 2 prime, I don't actually have them. They might be elsewhere. They might be on Saturn. Okay? But it doesn't matter. I'm just imagining they conceivably exist. But since quantum mechanics violates this, it must be the case, simply based on the statistics of the quantum correlations, that the statistical relation between 1 and 2, between spin 1 and spin 2, that statistical relation cannot be shared in this way. There cannot be other systems elsewhere, anywhere in the universe, that share the same statistical relation. with these guys, a conclusion I draw entirely from the observed correlations, not from the structure of quantum mechanics. Sure, would also have that property. Absolutely. Absolutely. Would also have the property. So the violation of this type of Bell inequality is proves that the statistical relation between entangled quantum particles is not shareable. But that's not based on the structure of quantum mechanics. It's based only on the statistical connections. In fact, I think that this is really what Bell's theorem is about. I think it's always been what it's about. I think that we've been talking about hidden variables, but hidden variables are simply a mechanism for making correlations shareable. So, because after all, let's consider a probability distribution over A and C, and if these things are mediated by hidden variables, that means this is going to be the conditional probabilities, which you have conditional independence, times some probability distribution over the hidden variables, whether they are what they are. But if I'm given some variable that's correlated with some hidden variables, I can always come up with another variable. These are just classical probability distributions. I can always come up with another variable that has the same. I can find an A prime with the same conditional distribution over lambda. I mean, if I have this, what I could say is that given lambda, I have some random process that generates A. Well, I could just give lambda here and by the same random process generate A prime. And in that case, this would be the sum over lambda P of A prime lambda P C lambda P lambda, which is, of course, just the same probability, joint probability distribution. So the hidden variables are simply a mechanism for enforcing the shareability of the correlations. Any number of things can be correlated in exactly the same way as A and C are. So in fact, the assumption of local hidden variables we can use that to show that that R12 is shareable in the sense that I've outlined. Oh! I'm not saying that I can, that I have the ability, the actual ability to make A prime. I'm saying that if lambda exists, then there could conceivably exist another A prime that has the same conditional distributions. There's nothing that prevents that from happening. It may be that I don't have any way to make that. But if the hidden variable exists, then it is conceivable.
Not conceivable.
The theory can say it's not conceivable. Well, since these probabilities, okay, this is an interesting distinction. So let's probe this for a moment. This is simply a statement about some probability distributions, classical probability variables, and if I have a joint distribution of a couple of variables, you can say, oh yes, and I guarantee that there's nothing else in the world that has exactly the same correlation with it, that has exactly the same joint distribution with lambda that A does. You can make that claim. And I say, oh, that's very good. But in fact, aside from your claim, there's nothing that could enforce that. That could be an assumption that there doesn't exist one. But what principle could exclude that from existing. If you have some classical variables which at some level, perhaps inaccessible to us, have values, why couldn't there be another classical variable with a value that has exactly the same correlation? What is it except saying, no, that doesn't happen? But, and remember, I'm not trying to, I'm trying to abstract away from particular assumptions about the underlying mechanism. It may be that the underlying mechanism is such that it happens, that you never have a process which produces them in this way. But the fact that you never happen to have such a process that produces them in this way doesn't mean that they could not exist in principle. Somewhere, in God's book somewhere, there could be something written down which is actually just the value of A. It's written down in God's book. And the value of A written down in God's book is correlated with lambda in exactly the same way as the value of A in the experiment. Okay? Right? Okay, so, all right. So, this leads that they're shareable, but that leads us to a Bell inequality, and my claim is that this is the real part. This is simply to allow us to do this. This is actually a strictly weaker assumption, by the way. Because you can have 1 prime, 2, and 2 prime in this way, doesn't mean you can have a 1 double prime and a 2 double prime and a 1 triple prime and a 2 triple prime with the same statistical relationships. No, it might not be that shareable. But the hidden variables assumption actually says you could have as many as you like, because you could repeat this for many different values for many different A primes. In fact, it's not just written down in God's book, it's also written in the devil's book. And other people's books. So it could be arbitrarily shareable. But no, you don't need arbitrary shareability. You only need shareability to this extent. You only need shareability to this extent. So this is a weaker assumption, actually, than this. This is shareable in this way. Okay. And the same thing works for all of the classic Bell type theorems. For instance, the GHZ theorem. Oh, let's do the GHZ theorem real quick. Okay. All right, so I've got three systems. I've got 1, 2, and 3, and I can measure, they're spin systems, and I can measure spin components on them, and I get plus or minus 1 on them. And I can measure X or Y on each of these. I've got X or Y. And it has these systems, there's a sort of a three-way statistical relation among them, which says that if you give me the measurements that you make on the three systems, I can write down the probability distribution over the outcomes. And that defines their statistical relation. And it turns out that I observe that if I measure x, y, y, or y, x, y, or y, y, x, when I take the product of the results, I always get plus 1 for the product of the results. It happens 100% of the time. That's my observation. Okay? Now, let's assume that the statistical relationship is shareable to the extent that I can have a 1 prime, a 2 prime, and a 3 prime. So if I take 1 from column 1, and 1 from column 2, and 1 from column 3, they're in that same statistical relationship. Okay? There are now 8 different statistical relationships. There's 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 prime, 1, 2 prime, 3, 1, 2 prime, 3 prime, and so on. There are 8 different statistical relationships, and I'm going to assume they're all the same. Assume 1 prime, 2 prime, and 3 prime exist. All are 1, 2, 3s the same. Okay? Yeah?
They actually exist, or is it they could exist?
How's that? They could exist. They could conceivably exist somewhere. And if they could exist somewhere, then you could imagine an experiment that involved 1, 2, and 3, and 1 prime, 2 prime, and 3 prime. In those experiments, we may want to do it many times, we're going to measure x on these guys and y on these guys. Okay? And so when we look at the data from these experiments, these conceivable experiments, there are going to be six columns. There's going to be columns for these guys, columns for these guys. And in the six columns, it must be that since they have the same statistical relationships, it must be that x, y prime, that's got to be plus 1. Because all guys have exactly the same statistical relationships. If this is always plus 1 for the three that I actually have, then it's always going to have to be plus 1 for the experiments that the conceivable experiments that I perform. And similarly, y prime x y prime has to be plus 1. And so y prime x has to be plus 1. This is true, going to be true in every line of that data table. And therefore, the product of all of them has to be plus 1. But the product of all of them is just, since y prime appears twice in each one, the product of all of them is just x, x, x. And so that must be plus 1. But in the GHZ state, which is, of course, 0, 0, 0, minus 1, 1, 1, the GHZ state, in fact, that's an eigenstate of x, x, s with eigenvalue minus 1. So if the statistical relationship between the three systems is shareable in this way, then they must violate observed properties of quantum systems. I guess it's sort of observed. I don't know if we've ever actually done a clean GHZ experiment. They did the NMR thing, but that's okay. Okay. So the relationship in the GHZ state is not shareable. And I conclude that not from the structure of multi-party entangled states in quantum mechanics, but from simply the statistical correlations among the systems. Okay, so lots of things you can say. Classical correlations are always shareable, but correlations might have a structure that implies that they're not shareable. They're not classical. The quantum mechanical correlations are that way. Monogamy, in this case, is a feature of correlations. It's a feature of the statistical correlations. It doesn't depend on the underlying structure of quantum mechanics. The underlying structure of quantum mechanics is wonderful, but the property of monogamy is not really about that. It's about what kind of correlations can exist conceivably between systems. Our assumptions, like statistical relations and the existence, possible existence of twins, if you will, twins of 1 and 2 that have the same relations with other systems that 1 and 2 have, the existence of these twins, these assumptions are kind of checkable in the sense that we can recognize statistical relations experimentally, and if somebody claims to have twinned systems, we can check that experimentally. And so I guess this is the only reason I would have done the talk on PowerPoint. This last remark. Perhaps you remember a cartoon from The Far Side, Gary Larson cartoon from The Far Side. And in this cartoon, as in so many of his cartoons, there's cows grazing in a field. And suddenly one cow looks up and says, "Hey guys, this is grass. We've been eating grass. I am that cow. I think that Bell's theorem is really about monogamy. It's really about shareability of correlations. And it's always been about shareability of correlations. We've been eating grass. So, that's all."
Yeah, sure, why not? There were some along the way. Yeah.
So I came late, so maybe I'll quickly answer that question. So you've shown that you can't have a system correlated with another system, and a third system also correlated with the first system in exactly the same way.
I've shown that there are ways that two systems could be correlated so that just from the structure of their correlations, I can conclude that there are no other systems which are correlated in the same way, in that way. Yeah. There could be such things. Not that it's always true, obviously. But.
You've eliminated this exact copy possibility.
Well, yeah, but yeah.
How close can you come to copying? Have you quantified the...
I believe that you can come up with situations where you can, just like in something I drew over here somewhere. I believe that you can come up with situations. It must have been over here, but I perhaps erased it. Oh, anyway, where you can have shareability up to a point, but not beyond that point in quantum mechanics. And something I'm thinking about now is, can you also show that as a property of some statistical correlations, that you can have statistical correlations, say, oh yeah, well, there could be a twin of one, and there could be two twins of number two, and they would all have the right cross relationships, but there couldn't be any more. I can conclude that from the statistical relations. That would be a really interesting fact, that you could go farther. You could have some degree of shareability, but not complete shareability, and that would be interesting in between this situation and the classical situation where you can have as many ones and twos as you like, in principle. Yeah.
So this dealt with, I guess you would call it exact shareability, and you're talking about if you have exact shareability, can you extend it? But can you quantify some of these things a little bit more?
So perturb off the idea that they have exactly the same probability distribution?
Yeah.
I don't know. You would think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah, sure.
Because, I mean, this is not like a very narrow result. Like, it's like it's big enough so you could have some epsilons. Yeah,
sure.
I don't know. Yeah?
Just wondering, what would you say about the quotient spectra theorem? That looks, on the face of it, to be a lot more closely tied to the structure of quantum mechanics.
Yeah, it does look like that. It's always sort of looked that way to me. This idea that there has to be this property of orthogonal triads and so on. What I really much prefer is the way that argument gets used in the free will theorem by Conway and Kokin, where this property of there are two spin one systems, and it's kind of this triad property that enforces a kind of locality. I'm not prepared to give a talk about that theorem right now, but I thought that the original theorem was not, I don't know, it didn't make me happy. It was interesting, but it seemed to include so much structure that it was less convincing. But that it actually did some interesting business. The orthogonal triad structure does some interesting business in the entanglement theorem that Conway and Kochin have come up with recently. So that's not an answer, but a meta answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe one of your points, if I'm correct, is that shareability is a potentially weaker property than local hidden variables.
Yeah.
And it still leads to the inequality that's the Bell inequality that's violated by quantum mechanics. Is it shareability really weaker than, have you thought about whether maybe in some
I'm pretty sure that you can come up with a quantum state. For instance, let's take that, and let's let all these guys be spins, and let's let each line represent a term in the Hamiltonian, which is the dot product of the spins. And let's look at the ground state of that. I'm pretty sure that the ground state of that has mixed states, and therefore has the same mixed state for any one and two pair. Okay, the ground state, which is an overall pure state, has the same mixed states for all these things. But quantum mechanics, the structure of quantum mechanics, wouldn't allow you to have other systems that were that had the same state, a two prime prime that had the same density operators with a one and two prime prime the same as those. There's some wrinkles of that I don't quite understand. So I think that's true. That's the part responsive to your question. But I'm not totally sure that's the part that sort of covers me in case that I've made a mistake so far. So, yeah. I don't know. That's a really cool question. I can't tell you. So in other words, if you if this inequality is if this inequality is violated to any degree, you can't be shareable in this sense. You can't have a copy on each side. For example, I don't know. Suppose I only require shareability on one side. Can I arrive at anything, any sort of conclusion? I don't know. I actually have not been able to show. If you have a one, can be suppose one is shared with two and two prime and two double prime and two triple prime, and you assume that there's the same statistical relationship between one and all the twos. Is that enough to derive some inequality that say quantum mechanics violates or at least is interesting? And I haven't been able to find something. I've needed to require shareability on both sides. So one thing that might be the case is that it could be maybe shareable one direction, but not both directions. Yeah, that's right, exactly. And that might be the case, and I don't know. Jeff.
For a comment or anything else, the Clausewitz-Shimoni Holt inequalities are equivalent to saying that your state space has the structure of a simplex, that is, as a convex set. If you've got, just say, two pure states, then all the mixed states are represented by the line of points between them, and for more complicated cases, a generalization of that. Now, the simplex is the unique structure where you have mixtures represented in a unique way in terms of pure states. You don't have the,
Okay.
And it's also, I think, the unique structure in which you have shareability. And so
arbitrary shareability.
I think it's arbitrary shareability.
Yeah, that is to say, the shareability of to any extent.
Yeah.
There's not just one and one prime and two and two prime, but there might be one, two double prime and one double prime and so on all the way down. Okay.
Effect. I mean, I think this result is related.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you probably just take one more.
Okay. Rob,
Two comments which are connected to it.
Yes.
It seems to me that there might be some results in the literature already that are connected with the inverse implication. So, the results that have to do with if you violate Bell inequality, then you get security.
Right.
Tells you that the kinds of correlations that Alice and Bob have can't be shared with the eavesdropper.
Right. And in fact, that's the topic of this paper I mentioned at the beginning by Jussin and Asin and the other Massanes. I haven't quite worked out the logical connection between what I'm saying and what they said, but that's clearly what they're up to. They're talking about security and violation of Bell's inequalities and shareability and the connections between.
The second comment is, I wonder whether this sort of approach might be able to provide an answer to the question of why quantum mechanics is at 2 root 2 in between the classical and the Searlesian map. So it could be that demanding shareability of imperfect correlations or demanding perfect correlation between a different set of parties gets you precisely to 2 root 2.
Mm.
And that
would be really interesting. Yeah. That would be really interesting. Okay. We should talk about it. Yeah, very good. So I should. Okay. Lunch sounds good.